Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Two brief housekeeping notes before we begin. The first is an apology to our regular listeners for the technical difficulties we experienced last week. The company that hosts our website was migrating files between servers when they had a major crash. We have the problem fixed, and we are once again up and running. Second, prompted by these technical problems and the interruption in our service, which affected our listenership, I have begun to think hard about how to popularize this free podcast series to a broader audience. While the good folks at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion and I will be putting our heads together in the next few weeks to brainstorm ways to build audience, I would like to solicit advice from you, our regular, or perhaps even new, listeners. Please send any thoughts you may have to tgill@uw.edu. That's tgill@uw.edu. We'd greatly appreciate it. Okay, now on with the show. Last year around this time, we featured a podcast on the religious influences in J.R.R. Tolkien's work, just in time for the release of the movie spectacular The Hobbit. One of the interesting themes of that podcast was Tolkien's interaction with C.S. Lewis, another British author who had a significant impact on Tolkien's work and life. Lewis looms large in the world of 20th century English literature, and although there are not any movies based on his works coming out this holiday season, the Narnia trilogy did receive a great deal of popular acclaim in recent years. But even though we are lacking any cinematic justification to talk about Lewis, there's another reason to discuss his life and literature. November 22, 2013 marks the 50th anniversary of his death. Interestingly, on the same day that Aldous Huxley died and the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. As I am not a consumer of fiction literature, nor am I in any way knowledgeable of C.S. Lewis beyond what I've seen in the Chronicle of Narnia films, I figured it would be important to pull in a guest who happens to be well-read in Lewis's work. Well, it just so happened that on a recent trip down to Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, I visited my good friend and colleague Micah Watson's office to see a large stack of C.S. Lewis books on his desk. Some of them I recognized, many I did not. He was using these books to teach a class on political theory or political philosophy. And I said, that's interesting. Let's talk about that on a podcast. And so here we are with the good Dr. Watson, an associate professor of political science at Union University, where he is also the director for the Center on Politics and Religion. Micah is currently working on several projects, which include how John Locke's religious views influenced his political theory, the biblical thought of Leo Strauss and Ernest Fortin, and a collaborative effort with his political theory colleagues at Wheaton and Westmont to consider the possibility of an evangelical tradition of political thought. He is also very tall and played basketball for UC Davis in his undergraduate days. Micah, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Yeah, I just had a chance to talk with you a few weeks ago, and it's good to have you on the show here talking about this C.S. Lewis guy. So start me off here by clearing up a bit of my ignorance regarding C.S. Lewis. I'm sure that many folks listening to this podcast know more about Lewis than I do, but so why don't you just fill me in on his personal background. Who is C.S. Lewis?
Well, sure. C.S. Lewis was born November 29th, so we're also coming up to his birthday, in Northern Ireland, and grew up thinking of himself as an Irishman. Was educated in England and had most of his career in England, spent most of his time in Oxford, and then also got a chair at Cambridge, moved midlife. He is known for a number of things. Was a writer, Christian apologist, a medievalist, a scholar, lived a very interesting life. I think one of the best-selling Christian authors of the 20th century. His works still sell every year on bestseller lists. If you were to take a poll of evangelical Christians in the United States, Mere Christianity is one of the books that remains on the most influential book after the Bible. Also very popular among Catholics, Orthodox, all sorts of folks. He had an enormous impact in several different realms, known for his imaginative works and his apologetics works. Just a larger-than-life figure. Also, as you mentioned, friends with Tolkien and Dorothy Sayers, a number of other figures around Oxford at that time. And then dies too early in 1963.
Yeah. Well, I got a question here. You said he's an Irishman. He's got that Lewis name and that. Did he grow up Catholic?
No, I think he would have grown up in what have been called the Church of Ireland, which was the Anglican version of that, and remained an Anglican apart from. He lost his faith with the death of his mother as a young boy, and then came back to his faith famously. But part of the whole ethos of mere Christianity in his work was he wanted to emphasize the things that Christians at all times and all places had held in common. So while in his private letters and other areas he will acknowledge his Anglicanism and we'll talk about it a little bit, he's pretty reluctant to talk about it much in his public writings because he doesn't want to really talk about the things that divide various Christian denominations. But he was an Anglican when he was a devout Christian.
Okay, so that's very interesting. It's interesting that he's popular among evangelicals here in the United States today because the Anglican Church oftentimes gets a great deal of criticism by the evangelical community. But, I mean, I guess as you said, he's talking as a mere Christian, capital C, with no denominational affiliation associated with that when he writes. Is that right?
Yeah, he has a metaphor in the opening, I believe, to Mere Christianity, where he talks about Christianity as being, there's a big hallway, and that's where every Christian can meet of various denominations, but the real fellowship is found, in the rooms, and you have to go into a door, and he likened each room to a different denomination. So his room within the greater, house of Christianity was Anglicanism, but he still thought that Christians, it was important for Christians to go out into the hallway and fellowship with other believers. And that's really where his own Christian work was found.
Now, you said he abandoned his faith after his mother died and he rediscovered his Christianity. What was the path here? Was it a relatively long process, a short process? What's going on in his life?
Well, his mom dies of cancer, and then his dad, who meant well, but I think must have himself have been suffering greatly, sent Lewis and he had an older brother as well, Warney, and he and Warney were best friends throughout their lives. He sent them off to boarding school, which in Lewis's life was just horrific, and he writes about this in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And in fact, one of the headmasters of one of the schools was later found to be insane, and the school was shut down entirely. Mm. And through this, he comes to realize that he does not believe, he cannot believe in a good God in this world in which he has suffered much and lost his mother.
And sent him to boarding school.
Just an awful boarding school.
Yeah, actually, this is a tangent here. It seems that that experience, from what little I know of C.S. Lewis's work through the films, the Narnia films, the boarding school comes into his writings, does it not?
It absolutely does. Yeah. If you recall Eustace, from The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, who is just a pill in the beginning of the book, and eventually better things happen. But Lewis has a remark about how he had been to a progressive school and had learned some awful things. So one of Lewis's enduring interests is education, and that comes up in his fiction and in his nonfiction. So it certainly you can see how he drew from his own experience. He hated sports. He hated the idea that he had to be. To do out and play the games and be what they expected him to be. He was more very bookish, very intellectual. He was at the age of 10, he was writing his notes to Milton's Paradise Lost. The house that he grew up in with his brother, it was a huge meandering house, and they played games and they made up worlds. He was making up imaginary worlds even before Narnia. So he was a quiet guy, and the rough and tumble of the school experience this was not to his liking. Even if it had been a great school, I don't think he would have enjoyed that part of it. But this was a particularly bad school. Mm. So he, as a young scholar, though, he does incredibly well. He gets a triple first from Oxford. In Oxford, you get a degree, and the highest you can get is a first. And he gets three of these. It's like triple majoring and getting a 4.0 in all of them. Yeah. And as a young man, as a young scholar, he is really interested in poetry, and he's interested in the poets. And he gets a book by a Scottish poet named George MacDonald called Fantasties. And he says, I had no idea what I was getting myself in for with this book. It baptized my imagination. And what happens is he begins to find these authors that just mesmerize him. And the funny thing is, a lot of them are Christians. And for a while, the Christian part he kind of puts up with, but then he comes to realize over a period of time, it wasn't an instant thing by any means, that the Christianity, the mythos that he's learning there, is part of what is so beautiful about them, part of what draws him in. And he comes to believe through conversations with Owen Barfield, a friend of his, and Tolkien, that Christianity is not just mythic, but in fact the true myth. And he talks about this in his autobiography. He comes to, as he puts it, surrender and admit that God is God, reluctantly, but he does do it over a long period of time.
When is this happening now? I mean, you mentioned this guy is bookish. He's, when he's very young, he's reading Paradise Lost. I mean, oh my gosh, I don't think I've ever even read that. So for a 10-year-old, that's pretty amazing. Is he one of these kids at Oxford at age 16 or 15, or is this happening in his early 20s? And this process that he's going through is re-Christianization, I guess I could call it.
Well, one of the best things that his dad finally wises up and realizes the school thing's not working and sends him to a private tutor his name was Kirkpatrick, called him the Kirk. And in fact, if you look at Professor Kirk from The Magician's Nephew and from the Narnia books, it's named after this professor, who ironically was an atheist. But he was a rigorous, logical, merciless thinker who Lewis loved and learned a lot. So in some respect, it starts there. And he gets Lewis prepared to go to Oxford and begin Oxford. He learns he's accepted, I think, when he's 18. So he's about the regular age when he gets to college.
Okay.
He becomes a Christian, or at least he starts talking about Christianity being a true myth in 1931. So he's 33, and that's after this conversation with Tolkien. And part of it was, Lewis thought that to believe in Christianity meant that he had to believe that every other religion was entirely false, that it was all bunk. And through conversations with Tolkien and some other friends, he realized that what he actually needed to believe was that Christianity was the most true and the true myth and the true story, and that in the other myths and the other religions, there were ways of God preparing the world for the advent of Christianity. It's like he was dropping hints. And so that helped Lewis, because he didn't think he had to reject everything else to accept Christianity.
So you're talking in his conversations with Tolkien and a few other folks, and in our podcast that we had last year on The Hobbit and J.R.R. Tolkien, which we'll link to on our website, they mentioned this group called the Inklings, which was, a coffee house or maybe probably brandy group that met and discussed things. And is he having an influence on Tolkien? Is Tolkien having an influence on him? Who are some of the players in this group, and how are they influencing one another?
Sure. Well, Tolkien and Lewis are the two stars that we would look back now and see, but there were other folks as well. There was Owen Barfield. Charles Williams was an author who wrote some very interesting sort of books that people tend to either really like or really not like. There were other folks who would drift in and out, and they would meet. They would often meet at the Eagle and the Child, which was a pub, or they also called it the Bird and the Baby. There were kind of two sorts of sessions. Sometimes they would just have sessions where they just talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. It would just be free-ranging discussion about whatever it was. At other times, they would actually read what they'd been working on. So Lewis would read something from the Chronicles of Narnia, or Tolkien would read something from The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, and they would give each other criticism. Lewis said at one point that there's nothing he liked better than the sound of adult male laughter, and this notion of this strong friendship and men getting together to drink beer and ale or stronger stuff, or perhaps have tea at times, was really one of the highlights, I think, of his life. And one of those things where you wish you could be a fly on the wall and have heard some of those conversations. What would have been like to hear Tolkien read The Hobbit or parts of Lord of the Rings and hear these fellows talk about it? And they really encouraged Tolkien. Tolkien, as you probably went over last year, the process of getting The Lord of the Rings done was such a long thing. And having some of these guys react so positively helped Tolkien get it done. On the other hand, Tolkien was very critical of the Narnia Chronicles. Did not like them at all, and was quite harsh in his criticism.
Yeah.
So it wasn't always, it was not a mutual admiration society. They loved each other enough to really let each other have it if they didn't like something.
Mm-hmm. And as we talked about last year, the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings trilogy really was this immensely complicated universe created with its own language and all that kind of stuff. And
right.
You could see that maybe Tolkien looked at Lewis and said, come on, Narnia, lions and stuff, come on, kick it up a notch here, I guess.
That's exactly right. One of the things Tolkien liked least was the introduction of Father Christmas, if you remember that scene in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And Tolkien created the language and then wanted characters and a story to speak the language, and everything just had a really strong logic, and there was a universe that was believable. And he thought that Narnia just was this, just mix of things thrown in and didn't have a logic that really cohered at the bottom.
Yeah. Well, I can see how that is. I've been through that criticism as an academic over beer a few times as well. Now, they're doing this when they're at Cambridge, right? This was Cambridge, not Oxford.
No, this would be Oxford.
Oxford. Okay, so it is Oxford. So he's a professor at Oxford. Did he just get his degree? He got the triple crown, or what did you call that again? The triple first, right? So he got the triple first.
They never actually gave him a professorship, and this was something that rankled him for some time. It was why Cambridge was able to get him away, I want to say in 1954, because Cambridge would give him a chair. That's 1954 is when he goes to Cambridge. And so Oxford had him as a tutor, and he would meet with students. And you see this if you've seen the movie Shadowlands. He's meeting with students frequently, which I have no doubt that he was very good at. And you can read some of his letters to his students, and they're often very, very great. But it was also, it was a huge, took a great deal of time that he otherwise might have been writing or working on things. So when he does go to Cambridge, he gets a professorship, which means he doesn't have any students. He can just focus on his work. So Oxford, in some ways, tried to get, found out Cambridge was trying to get him and tried to get him themselves. There's some feeling that some of his colleagues at Oxford resented the popular work that he had done, the children's books, the Christian apologetics, and perhaps did not give him his due as the serious and quite accomplished medievalist that he was.
And that's interesting, writing popular press type of books, children's books, nonetheless, and apologetics. Tell us a little bit about his general stream of literature, because I think most people are probably relatively familiar with, Screwtape Letters, Chronicles of Narnia, Mere Christianity, but he has a pretty big catalog, and I don't think many people know this. Give us a sense of how this progressed and where the major stepping stones are.
Well, sure. The first book that he writes after his conversion is called The Pilgrim's Regress, and a lot of people are critical of this book. And Lewis himself was critical later, thinking that it was a little bit too many Easter eggs hidden in there that the reader might not know about, and perhaps even too polemical. We can think of dividing his writing. I mean, there's so many different genres that he does write about, but he has several academic works that were very important in their field. The Allegory of Love, The Discarded Image. These deal with poetry and with literature. He had a very long project called the Oxford History of the English Language of the 16th Century, excluding drama, for which he read every book of that era in the Oxford Library.
Wow!
So one area is he has these academic books which we most people wouldn't have reason to run across, but then he has the famous books like you mentioned that are straightforward apologetics. You have The Problem of Pain, you have Miracles, you have Mere Christianity, which grew out of the radio talks he did for the BBC during World War II. And then you have his more imaginative works, Screwtape Letters, which is featured when he's on the cover of Time magazine in the U.S. in 1947 with a Screwtape Devil in the background, and then The Great Divorce, the Narnia books, the Space Trilogy, one of the first, in 1938, Out of the Silent Planet comes out. So he's got these different tracks, science fiction, children's literature, rational apologetics. Then he has some more pastoral works about prayer, about the four loves. Just an insane number of different genres that he's writing in by the time that he passes away.
Yeah, that is quite amazing to see an academic dipping his fingers into so many different pots that you know, today we don't see that. We become so narrowly specialized, but here's somebody who's doing poetry. He's doing Christian apologetics. He's writing science fiction. I didn't know he read science fiction. What's this space trilogy about? Is this some kind of Isaac Asimov wannabe, or is he really making his mark with science fiction?
Well, you know, different, that's the, you know, the great thing about those different people will find different parts of his work, either, you know, enthralling or not. Paralandra is the second book of the space trilogy, and it's the favorite book, one of the two favorite books that he wrote. The other book I should have mentioned that he wrote along with his wife, Joy Gresham Lewis, was called Till We Have Faces, which is also one of his favorite books. Out of the Silent Planet follows a philologist, right, which is what Tolkien was. Someone studies the origins of words and the structure of language. And this character's name is Ransom, and through a series of misadventures and adventures, he ends up on a spaceship going to Mars. And in Mars, along with a couple other human beings who are up to no good, encounters life forms there and all sorts of adventures, and then comes back, which sets up the second story. The third story is set in England and revolves around university life and government and politics and utopian schemes. And in some ways, it's Lewis's imaginative telling of the story that does in fiction what he's doing in his straightforward work, The Abolition of Man, which is a philosophical work about natural law and education. So it's almost like he's working on two tracks. He's getting his point across in straightforward rational apologetics arguments, and then he's also illustrating his arguments by fleshing out the ideas by having characters live them out and seeing what happens when they do.
Was this a conscious strategy by him to reach a more popular audience instead of just the stodgy old academics hanging around the corridors of Oxford or Cambridge?
I don't think it was conscious at first. He describes how he writes by saying these images come into his head. He sees a fawn carrying a parcel through a snowy wood. He sees a magnificent lion, and then that part of the process sparks, you know, where the story comes from. He says, what would a story look like that has these different elements? So he did not start thinking, gosh, how do I incorporate Christianity into these children's books? The pictures came first. But that said, he later wrote about how as a child he felt stymied in religion because he knew he was supposed to feel a certain way, that he was expected to feel reverence with regard to the crucifixion or various Christian doctrines. And he felt that the obligation to feel froze his feelings, that he couldn't do it. So he describes how writing about these things in a way that bypasses that. The word he uses, he thought that writing that way could steal past these watchful dragons, he called them, watchful dragons being the obligation to feel, and that the ideas, if presented in this roundabout way, can get in a way that just being told you have to believe and feel a certain way could not. So I think he came to realize how powerful story and narrative were in getting some of these ideas across, but I don't think he started out that way by conscious strategy.
You know, one of the other things that you mentioned, and this is rather intriguing to me, I didn't know he did this, again, not being very familiar with his work, was that he did radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that must have been very out of sync for the common academic. I mean, this guy seems like an academic rebel.
Well, I think that's right. I don't think he was asked during World War II. I would imagine perhaps some of his colleagues would give him some slack, given the unprecedented nature of what it must have been like living under siege at that time. This is before the U.S. had gotten into the war.
Mm-hmm.
But he, as anyone who's read Mere Christianity knows, it's very accessible. And he, writing it for radio, he's writing it for the regular Joe. And he also went around and gave talks to the Royal Air Force. He would give talks to the regular soldier. And he himself was a soldier, something we didn't mention. He served in World War I and was wounded. This is one of the real gifts of Lewis, is that he has the academic and intellectual chops to really do top-notch scholarly work, but he has a knack for explaining that and illustrating that in the vernacular in a way that just regular folks can understand and resonate with. And I think that's why his popularity remains, and I also think that's why, to some extent, he may have been resented by some of his his academic colleagues.
Yeah, no, I think that still resonates throughout academia, that there are certain audiences that you write for and styles in which you write for and styles in which you write that give you, as you say, the intellectual chops that allow you into the priesthood of academia. And if you start getting outside of that, your work is seen as of less quality in many regards. So, yeah, I don't know. Let's get back and talk about the general flow of his work over his life course. And as you mentioned, Pilgrim's Regress was one of the first major pieces that he writes, and he later on regrets this, you say. How does his work progress throughout the course of his life? Now, give us some period of time here. Pilgrim's Regress to the time of his death in 1963. How long of a period are we talking there?
That's 30 years. So Pilgrim's Regress comes out in 33. He converted, you know, back to Christianity just 2 years prior to that. So you really have a 30-year period. And one thing I'll just add real quickly, while he's writing all this, when he gets popular, he gets a slew of letters, and he responds to every one. So almost every day he starts off by spending time writing responses or dictating them eventually to his brother. So in addition to all this academic output and all this creative output, he's writing, you know, hundreds of letters to everyone who writes to him. It's just a fascinating insight there into just kind of person he was, that he would take the time to do that, even after he'd become, you know, this kind of major figure.
Yeah, Dash, I just have to say aside that that's amazing that he does that. I know with email we get a lot of stuff, and I try to respond, but a lot of them I just ignore. But I'm starting to think that this guy did all of this in 30 years and is writing letters back to people. I think the days were longer than 24 hours back then. Like, he must have had 36 hours per day or something. That's incredible amount of writing that he does.
And he said, you know, there's not a book too big or a cup of tea too big for me. I mean, he was caffeinated. He stayed up. He worked on it. But yeah, this was his life. He was a bachelor for most of his life, and lived, you know, but he did an amazing amount. And it's boggles the mind. I think email probably would have killed him.
Yeah.
Cause it would have been insane how many emails he would have gotten if he'd lived today.
No, I understand. So he was a bachelor for a significant portion of his life.
That's right. Part of what happens in his life, when he goes to fight in World War I, he and a friend named Patty Moore make a pact. You know, Lewis's dad at that time is a bachelor. Patty Moore's mom is alive, and they say if either one of us gets killed, the other one will take care of the parent. Well, Patty Moore does get killed in World War I, and Lewis ends up entering a relationship with his mother, Patty Moore's mother, Janie Moore, with whom he has a relationship and then takes care of until her death. And if you read the biographies of Lewis, and this was, I mean, in terms of looking at what he did, he was a servant in taking care of her when she got older and had her own problems. Lewis's brother Warney resented her greatly. So he had this sort of relationship, which is controversial in terms of figuring out exactly what happened there. But he marries Joy Davidman Gresham in 1956, and so has 4 years of marriage before she passes away, I think in 1960. Mm-hmm. 1960 she passes away. So he does have he first marries her so she can stay in the country. This is a story famously told in Shadowlands. Mm-hmm. Although even before that, if you look at Alan Jacobs, Alan Jacobs, the Baylor professor, has a great biography. He talks about how things appeared to be moving towards a more romantic relationship even before the legal aspect of it, of getting married, and then they fall in love and have these 4 years of happiness, because she dies of cancer, but she gets a remission and has 3 years of great health. They take a trip to Greece, and Lewis is able to enjoy being married until she passes away in 1960.
So that took us a little bit afar from where we were going, but
sorry about that.
No problem. This is interesting stuff to learn about, because learning about the author's life and life experiences tells us a lot about the works that they do write. So let's get back to that question about how he progresses in this roughly 30-year period from Pilgrim's Regress until he dies in 1963. What are some of the major themes that come about? Do these things change over time? Is there a maturing of his writing, or is it fairly constant?
Well, I think one of the things that we see in his earlier years of being becoming a Christian, he does write a number of the straightforward rational apologetics. You know, problem of pain, miracles, mere Christianity, the abolition of man. And then the later part of his writing career, he's not writing straightforward apologetics. And there's a particular incident that some biographers think is really fundamental for this. Lewis was the president of what was called the Socratic Club at Oxford. And what this was a debating society. And after he had published Miracles, a philosopher named G.E.M. Anscombe, talk about your acronyms, it was Gertrude Elizabeth Margaret Anscombe. She was one of the prize students of the philosopher Wittgenstein. She came and delivered a talk on part of Lewis's Miracles book and apparently just ripped it apart. I mean, she just went after it. She was a serious Catholic, very devout Christian, but she would agree with Lewis's argument in the book. The argument was about naturalism, the idea that nature is all there is, but she found that the way he went about arguing against it was flawed. And Lewis, after that point, does not write another straightforward apologetic. He fixes the article, the chapter of Miracles. He amends it. He never renounces the power of reason or rational apologetic. He actually affirms it even late in life. But he moves towards writing books that he thinks can influence people through narrative and fiction more so than the straightforward apologetics. Mm-hmm. So I do think that's a major shift. Now, some people think that, you know, that this just destroyed him, that he was a shell of a man, and it was never the same, and I think those claims are overblown. One biographer says that the white witch, Jadis, is patterned after Anscombe, and I think that's a bit, you know, speculative. But I do think it's the case that Lewis comes to rely more on stories and narrative in terms of what he's really focusing on than the sort of straightforward apologetics he did earlier. So that's one fairly significant shift, I think.
Before you move on to other significant shifts and change, I do have to ask this because you just mentioned Anscombe, and her first name was G.E.M., and Lewis, as we refer to him as C.S. What does C.S. stand for?
Clive Staples.
Oh.
Clive Staples. So that's perhaps not the most felicitous of names. When Lewis was a very young boy, I want to say 3 or 4, he looked at his mother and put his, you know, thumb to his chest and says, "Me Jaxie. Me Jaxie." and then the next day he insisted that he'd still be Jaxie. And so Lewis was known to his friends as Jack for all of his life. Everyone who knew him personally would never call him Clive or C.S. They called him Jack. So I think the C.S. is just a shorthand way of not having to spell out Clive Staples, which I don't think he cared for a whole lot.
Is that true? Because you had J.R.R. Tolkien then, too, and G.E.M. Anscombe, and it just seems that in the middle part of the 20th century, everybody was using their initials as their names. I'm just weird. I don't know.
Yeah, in fact, you know, if we could redo this, I could rather you call me M.J. Watson.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do that. We'll call you M.J. from now on, but so go ahead and continue. So there's that one shift. He's shifting towards a more literature-based apologetic approach. And what this shift occurs about when?
I want to say the debate with Anscombe is in the late 1940s,
okay.
1948, perhaps. But I don't you know, hold me to that exactly on that date. But I want to say that's when it is. He's writing fiction and narrative before that. The Space Trilogy comes out before that. So that's always been there, but I think that the emphasis goes more on that after that debate.
I see. What other things are changing, evolving, or staying the same in his literature?
Well, I think, you know, it's remarkable what stays the same. I think we talk about the idea of the mere Christianity idea, that he thought that he could be of best service by shoring up the faith in areas, you know, that all Christians across time had agreed on that were under attack. So he is throughout his career interested in defending the notion that people can access morality, that God has built us to know things morally, the idea of a natural law, something that he is frequently writing about.
I'm going to pause you right there. Sure. And I need you to explain this to me because, again, political philosophy is not my strong suit. And I hear so many people talk about natural law I need somebody to explain what that is.
Well, natural law is a term that, you know, is one of these terms that gets tossed around, and there's lots of different definitions of it. But and Lewis didn't like the term. When Lewis writes The Abolition of Man, he talks about the Tao. And what he means by that, this is T-A-W, he means objective morality, the idea that there are things that are right and wrong in the universe, and they're part of the reality of the universe. So to say that, you know, you think theft is right, and I think it's wrong, we just differ. We agree, disagree. To think of morality like we think of choosing ice cream flavors is a mistake. So the idea of natural law, you know, Lewis says something about this that I think is helpful. He says, he relates it to God, that God has made the world in a certain way and has created our nature to work in a certain way. So he says, God made us, invented us as a man invents an engine. A car is made to run on petrol, and it would not run properly on anything else. Now, God designed the human machine to run on himself. He himself is the fuel our spirits were designed to burn, or the food our spirits were designed to feed on. There is no other, end quote. And so I think what Lewis means by this is there are certain ways that we're supposed to live, certain moral rules, and one of the things that he was at pains to emphasize is that while God is the author of this nature and of natural law or the Tao, even those who don't recognize God still have some notion, still have some access to the way that God intended them to live. Even those who aren't Christians can know that they need to honor their parents and that it's wrong to murder. We still have that semblance of the Imago Dei, even though we're fallen. So when Lewis is talking about natural law or objective morality, he's basically referring to the notion that we have this sense of right and wrong, and even with our fallen reason and, you know, from the result of the fall, we still can access that and we kind of know it. In fact, because we know it, because we know there's a law, we can't carry it out. We then set ourselves up for the knowledge that there's someone who did live out that law perfectly and can redeem us. So he sees natural law in some ways both as a key to moral action, but also an apologetic tool. We realize that there's something wrong with us. The gospel is only good news if we recognize the bad news, that there is an order to the world and we keep screwing it up.
Yeah, I see how that works in his rational apologetics in that regard. And I can also see how this can be blended into his more literary approach to apologetics by just telling these stories all the time, because it seems to me, and I got this sense too when we did the Tolkien podcast, that there are these eternal truths that's shared across culture and across time, and it does lend itself very easily to the notion of natural law, you know, the idea of, you know, don't kill one another, the idea of sacrificing for those around you, and you know, love seems to be a universal characteristic.
Yeah, that's a very Louisian point, right? He wants to emphasize. He asks us to imagine a culture in which men were admired for running away in battle. We don't see that. You know, imagine a culture. And now, when he writes this, it actually made sense. You know, he says at one point, in most cultures, a man might have one wife or three or four, but he's not allowed to have as many as he wants. And when he said that back in the 40s, that was more true than it is now. But this is The Abolition of Man. He goes through and he looks at all these different codes from all over the world and all over time. He finds some striking similarities in terms of what's right and what's wrong, and he sees that as a clue to, you know, God's fingerprints on the universe.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about some of his lesser known works, because when I was in your office last week, I noticed this big stack of books, not just one or two or three. If you would have asked me a few weeks ago, how many works did Lewis write, I'd say, well, let's see, I got Screwtape Letters, Chronicles of Narnia, Mere Christianity. Oh, yeah, it's about four or five, I'd probably say seven. But you had a pretty big stack, and a lot of them were lesser-known ones. So what were some of his works that were not well-known, like the Chronicles of Narnia or Mere Christianity? Were these tangential to his writings, or were these part and parcel of it? Was he just scribbling notes somewhere, or what?
Well, he had a number of different works that came out in different venues. I mean, many of the books that you saw were collected after his death and put together by admirers. And given, you know, how popular Lewis is, we understand why there's a market for these works. So some of these are sermons. There's a collection that's in a book called The Weight of Glory. The Weight of Glory was a tremendous sermon that he gave at one point. There's another collection called God in the Dock. It takes a number of Lewis's essays. Some of them are even just letters written to the editor of a newspaper, or you know, he has a little essay on the welfare state, or and then there's another book called Present Concerns, which even though Lewis did not keep up with current events, did not like newspapers, he did write on some things that would be pertinent, contemporary, of contemporary relevance. And so there's a number of these collections of his essays. And, you know, if you're a Lewis fan, then they're great. And then I think some of them, being, you know, interested in politics and political thought, I find some of them extremely interesting and helpful, just of their own right. I think that they're well worth reading.
I want to go down that avenue right now, because when I was at your office a week ago, you were telling me about this course and how you're fitting it into political theory or political philosophy. And I thought that was pretty interesting. You were not just reading the big works, Mere Christianity or something, but taking a lot of some of these different bits and pieces and bringing them to the table with your students to talk about the role of politics, and more specifically, the role of religion in politics. And we don't normally think of Lewis's writings in this light. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing in that class. I guess this would be getting some of your education for free here, not having to pay union tuition or anything. But I'm fascinated what you'd be doing with this. What are some of the themes? And actually, I guess my first question would be, was Lewis very politically active to begin with?
Well, it depends. The quick answer is probably no. Like I said, he did not. He loathed newspapers. He took pains to not be pigeonholed as, you know, one political flavor or another. I mean, remember, he doesn't even want to emphasize the denominational differences among Christians, because he doesn't want to bring up divisions that could hurt Christian unity. Mm-hmm. So he's particularly loath to be seen one way or the other politically. In fact, in 1952, Winston Churchill wanted to nominate him as a commander of the Order of the British Empire, which is an honor. It's just a step right below knighthood. And Lewis politely declined, saying that if he did accept that, it would allow some of his critics to paint him as a certain way politically. So in one sense, he's not politically active. At the same time, I do want to say that because he was interested in the great ideas, and because he was so well-read over so much time, what he does raise politically, the themes about living a good life, about what's important, about justice and equality, because they weren't always tied to specific events, they're actually somewhat more accessible, right? They're timeless, perennial issues.
Right.
So, getting information on Lewis and what he thought about a bicameral legislature or parliament, I mean, that's not where he's going to be very helpful. But on some of these larger themes, I think he's still relevant.
I'd be interested in some of those larger themes, because when you think about the context in which he's writing, this is the mid part of the 20th century, and, you know, 1930s, 1940s, you see the rise of fascism and how that gives rise to World War II and the destruction that wreaks across all of Europe. And you're also dealing with communism during this period of time, a very atheistic political philosophy, and what's going on in Stalin's Russia. I mean, he couldn't be immune from this. Are these some of the bigger issues that he's wrestling with?
Absolutely, and in fact, in The Pilgrim's Regress, you even see it in the early 1930s. He has certain allusions to both communism and, I think, Nazism. So he's definitely aware of these things. He's thinking about these things, and you know, at one point, he and Tolkien worried. I'm pretty sure about this. I'll give a little caveat, but they worried if Germany were to overtake Britain, would some of the things that they'd written before get them in trouble, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not only just an academic concern, it was very much a real-life concern.
Mm-hmm.
I think, very much interested and involved in those areas, although he's not, you would not call him a political polemicist. He's not a George Orwell, for example, writing explicitly about those things. It's more subtle than that, more in the background a little bit.
Do you see some of the subtext in the works, I mean, I'm thinking, again, the works I'm most familiar with are the Chronicles of Narnia, which I only saw in the film version of it. So I really did see a lot of political subtext about World War II in that work. I mean, one, it was set during that period of time. But number two, when they go to Narnia, there just seems to be some of these perennial political struggles going on.
Well, Lewis did address matters of war. He during World War II, he was actually invited by the London Pacifist Society, and he gave an address, which we now have, titled "Why I Am Not a Pacifist." And you see that reflected in the Narnia books. Prince Caspian is a pretty martial movie and book. Lewis thought that a Christian could and should at times embrace the duties of even violence for a good cause. So you definitely see that aspect there in his thought, both in the fiction and in his, you know, in his argumentative talks.
Mm-hmm.
So you see in the books some of his one of his most interesting essays is called Equality, and Lewis defends hierarchy. He says that, you know, we need equality legally, and we need more of it, he said, economically. But a culture that goes after equality, or a society goes after equality in its culture, that says, has every man saying, I'm as good as you, is on a suicide run. He thinks that that's very dangerous, that equality is not good in and of itself, but equality is like medicine or clothes. It's a result of the fall, and that when we mistake it as something good, then we really set ourselves up for trouble. So you see some of those more provocative ideas in Narnia with the kings and the queens, and also in his writings, his straightforward writings.
Are these themes that you talk about in your class with students? I mean, say, for instance, the equality theme. Have you covered that in your class, and how have students taken to this?
Well, I have to be kind of sneaky about it because, you know, we're a Baptist university, and so we don't have saints. But if we did have a saint, it would be Saint Lewis, in a sense. Lewis here is very much revered. And so what I do with this particular piece in Equality, I will print it out, but I won't put his name on it. And because it's a lesser-known work, as you mentioned, they can get through it and not know that it's him, and we'll talk about it. And, you know, if there's anything that's running through the veins of your, you know, everyday American, it's egalitarianism. It's that we're all equal and God loves us all equally. And so this, you know, Lewis's writing here, that gives a provocative idea that equality has its place, right? But it's not a good in itself. And it leads to some very fruitful discussions. And then when they find out, oh, this is Lewis, it gives them a little bit of a shock, and we talk about it even more. So, I do use these essays, and if nothing else, they lead to some great conversations.
How do you sneak that in? I mean, is your class, I have to back up and ask specifically about your class. Is your class something the name of C.S. Lewis's Political Thought, or is it something else, you know, Political Thought in the 20th Century, and you have a few weeks on Lewis or something?
Well, I have a class called Modern Christian Political Thought, and we do Lewis at the end.
Okay.
And then in other classes, I have a Western political thought class where we look at, you know, the big, you know, the Hobbes, Locke, those guys. And they're also dealing with equality. But one of the things that we're doing, you know, at Union is we're trying to think Christianly about these guys. And so occasionally we'll have discussion not only about the text for that day of Machiavelli or whomever it is, but I'll have another reading that somehow links what we've talked about to either a contemporary event or whatever. And so that's where I'll sneak it in. And I'll ask them to draw the lines or draw the parallels between the short reading we'll do in class and whatever was assigned for that day.
You are so sneaky. Do your students get mad at you that you pull these tricks on them?
If they do, they hide it well.
Okay. So how did they react when they read this tract on equality and then you told them, oh, by the way, this is C.S. Lewis?
Well, we do a little guessing game. Sometimes they can kind of figure it out. What's interesting is in this essay, Lewis also mentions, you know, the best relationships we have are ones where we're acknowledging ourselves to be under someone else or over someone else, right? A student and a mentor, a child and a parent, and he also mentions a husband and a wife, which, you know, he had a very traditional view of gender relations. This was before he was married. He may have changed when he got married. So that aspect brings out, you know, some good discussion with our students to what extent they buy. And some of them agree with Lewis and some of them don't. But it's, you know, it adds a nice, because it's, they haven't read it, is it, well, you know, it adds a nice flavor to the class.
Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and talk about Lewis's legacy. And I want to do this in two parts. I want to talk about his legacy in contemporary life, but then also how he has impacted your life and your thought politically or theologically. Let's go start with the less personal one, and how has Lewis's legacy been over the past 50 years since his death? Was this guy recognized immediately upon his passing as this is the guy, or has his legacy grown over the years? I mean, it seems like in the past 10 years with the Narnia movies that there's been a renaissance of C.S. Lewis. Has it had its ups and downs, or has this guy been just known as the guy to go to?
I think it's probably had its ups and downs, although it's been mainly up for quite some time. You know, as we mentioned in the beginning, you know, when Lewis passed away, hardly anyone knew because the JFK thing had so overshadowed it. And I'm not sure when exactly, and someone will know, but I'm not sure when exactly we'd say that things really took off. I think probably some of it came about when, you know, when evangelicals, you know, in the 1970s begin re-engaging, you know, after Roe v. Wade, and you have Francis Schaeffer coming along, and you have evangelicals becoming interested in the life of the mind, and here is this Oxford don whose academic and intellectual credentials are beyond reproach, who's unapologetically defends Christianity in really winsome ways and writes these incredible stories. I mean, I think evangelicals found in Lewis the perfect person to inspire them, to help them, that they could try and go and do likewise in their own intellectual and life of the mind odyssey. So I suspect at some point there, that's when the books really start taking off. And I think since then it's just built. I mean, there's a, you know, Wheaton College and Westmont College, two, you know, very good Christian colleges, have this ongoing feud as to which one has the authentic Lewis wardrobe. Each of them have a wardrobe from Lewis's, you know, that was Lewis's, and they'll fight with each other on which, you know, who has the more authentic one, which gives you some idea of just how kind of revered he is among evangelical Christians in the U.S.
I thought evangelicals were supposed to play down that iconography and not worry about saints, but they probably have a pair of shoes somewhere that they put in a glass case or something and say,
we have our relics.
We have our relics, I guess. Yeah, that is true. And it's interesting how that always comes back and how that in many ways inspires us. You go to a museum and you see these are Lewis's shoes and he was sitting there writing Narnia or Mere Christianity, talking on the radio when he did that. And, you know, those things help to put you back into the context. And I think are very inspirational in some regards. So what other,
that's right.
So what other impact has he had in terms of the broader culture?
Oh gosh. Well, I think among some, there's almost a backlash. It's like, okay, you know, we need to talk about someone else other than Lewis. And I think there's something to that, you know, you can almost become calcified. Lewis would be, I think, a little embarrassed by all this attention in some ways, and would want us to be thinking about. We want some of us to be trying to do the things that he was doing for our time and looking forward. I don't know how to measure the impact he's had. In one sense, just speaking, you know, as a Christian, I think of so many people whose faith has been encouraged. And even some people whose faith has been, you know, God's used Lewis's writings to help bring to the faith. Charles Colson had an enormous impact on the church in America, and he writes about how Mere Christianity was instrumental in his own conversion. So on an eternal scale, I think Lewis's impact is immeasurable. And then with regard to Christians engaging in the arts and engaging in narrative and trying to winsomely present the truths of the faith, I think it's we're still seeing the impact spread and grow, and I don't know when we'll see the end of it.
And that's one thing that I have thought about when I saw the Chronicles of Narnia movie. I'm not too much into that genre of film with the, you know, mythic representations and other worlds and knights and shining armor kind of thing like that. But it is, you know, those movies were immensely popular. Not just amongst Christians, but everybody. And all of a sudden people saying, oh, you know, this has a Christian theme. I guess you Christians are not as stodgy and unfun as we always thought you were, right? So how has Lewis impacted you? I guess we can close with that question here, because I always like to know what influences scholars in their own works. And has Lewis had an impact on you? And if so, when? Was this something as an early child, or is it something that you've rediscovered? Has the impact been variable or none at all?
No, I think, you know, the danger for me is not reading too much Lewis. I need to read other things too. As a child, my parents read the Chronicles of Narnia to me, so I had those stories read to me as a kid, and I loved those. I think, though, the earliest, most powerful experience I had with Lewis, I was probably 13 or 14, and I was raised as a pastor's kid, and my parents, great parents, raised me in the faith. But at that point, starting to, you know, look at other things and question, and I realized, you know, at that point, most teenagers are able to see their parents, as great as they are, aren't perfect, and I thought, you know, is this Christianity thing all there? And I started reading Mere Christianity, and here was this guy who was able to affirm and back up and even, you know, extend what my parents had said about the faith in a way I just found, it just made sense. It just seemed right, and it helped me, I guess, believe. Because here's this really smart guy who had written these other books that I really liked, and he's able to communicate the gospel and anticipate, you know, problems and objections, and he didn't sweep them under the rug. He didn't make a fairy tale about them, but it just dealt with them seriously, and it really just helped solidify. It really was I don't know how to describe it, except that it started me down a path of trying to understand my faith and relate to God in the whole facet of who I am. And the more I learned about Lewis, the more amazed I got. I don't think he's perfect. You know, if we had more time, a couple things I think were not great, but it's hard for me not to look at the life he lived and what he left behind with his writings and not think that God used him powerfully in a lot of folks' lives, and including my own. And I still go back to him, and in fact, my own work now, I'm still working on it. I'm working with a colleague, Justin Dyer at Missouri. We're working on a manuscript on Lewis's political thought. Whether it's my own raising my own family with reading them the Chronicles of Narnia, or my own work, there's you know, go too far without finding a Lewis reference or a Lewis thought pretty close by.
Yeah, the story that you told here today was very inspirational for me as an academic as well, because you look at how many different avenues he used to reach a wide number of people, and that is something that we try to do here on the podcast, and I've been trying to do in my work as well. So he definitely is somebody to put up there on the shelf and try to emulate the best we possibly can. So some great words of wisdom about a great Christian individual today. Micah Watson, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.